This is the time, and this is the record of the time.
This is us speaking normally.
This is the time, and this is the record of the time.
Is there a reason that people say that? This is the time and a record of the time? Is
Nobody that says that. Only I say that.
Okay.
That comes from a Laurie Anderson lyric from 1980, I want to say 485.
Okay. This is the time and what?
This is the time, and this is the record of the time.
That sounds like Laurie Anderson.
And this is the record of the time.
Now that you keep saying it,
yeah.
I hear it, her
yeah.
voice.
And I say it a little bit in her inflection.
You do. You actually have that. That helped. I when you said it, I started to see lighting.
Yeah.
And her on the stage.
Yeah. I don't do a lot of impressions. I've started working on a new impression. I wonder if it's even good enough to play on audio now that I think about it. I've been working on a Woody Allen impression. It's very much the same as my Henry Winkler impression, only significantly less reverse home mortgage and significantly more alleged pedophilia. I just got back from England where I accepted the Lewis Carroll Award for overly avuncular behavior. I don't want to say my date for the event was young, but she wore a lacy training bra from Victoria's Can You Keep a Secret collection.
That's funny.
Thank you.
That's funny.
For the record, I believe Bill Cosby is innocent.
For the record,
if he were any more innocent, I would find him very attractive.
Oh, that's terrible. That's terrible.
I'll go after 80-year-old comics that I've never met.
That's all right. And we've started the show, so whatever.
Oh, have we?
I've read a lot of those Woody Allen books. You know, he's got
Without Feathers
Whatever the...
Getting Even. And there's another one that I don't remember.
Yeah, in my early 20s, I read those books. And, you know, in The Disorderly Orderly, Jerry Lewis gets the maladies that people are around him. He's a nurse, and he...
The
old people, of course, are talking about how they're sick, and whatever they say, he's getting it. So, yeah, with these books, I read it, and then I started to write that way, and, you know, you get connected with somebody's voice, and, it was really great to write.
I have a story that is... that a lot of people have loved a lot. I'm trying to remember what it was called. Now I wound up changing the title from the original. But I wrote it right after I had reread all of the Salinger stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And I wrote an entire story in the style of Salinger. And I hat tipped to him in the middle of it. When you read somebody enough, you get their voice and their...
Yeah, it's a great exercise.
Yeah.
Let me do the intro to the show, and then we'll just move on.
Do we have to be formal?
Well, I think the show needs an intro. When people
All
tune
right.
in, then it's good
right.
for them
However
to know
like
what the show
things.
Is.
However you like to do things.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Comedy Death Star, the podcast that digs into the dark side of comedy. I am your host, Denzel Myers. Our guest this week is Dylan Brody.
I will be playing the part of Dylan Brody.
Playing the part of Dylan Brody will be Dylan Brody, award-winning playwright, humorist, and published author.
All true.
All right, that's good. Dylan has also two full-length CDs released by Stand Up Records.
That's an old bio. May I amend?
Yeah, they not. Is that
five full-length CDs from Stand Up Records and two digital downloads, one video, one audio from rooftopcomedy.com.
Okay, so that's also true. And you can hear his funny and touching stories on Sirius XM Satellite Radio's Laugh USA.
I believe that is true.
Every day. They're daily?
I don't know. I don't monitor it.
Okay.
I just get checks.
Got it.
Residual or royalty checks. I don't know what they are, but they come to my mailbox and I cash them.
That's a good practice.
Yeah.
You've been opening for David Sedaris in the past year?
The last 3 years, every time he's been on the West Coast, he has invited me to open for him. The first year he did it, we did it at the Pasadena Civic Center. The year after that, I was in both San Diego at the Balboa Theater and in Berkeley at the Zellerbach Hall.
Yes.
And then last year I was with him at the beautiful Helly Performing Arts Center.
Yeah.
He puts me in front of my favorite audiences up until today.
Did he bring you here?
No. Today, you are putting me in front of what is now my favorite audience.
Oh, okay. Well, thanks, because I thought
You're
it
welcome.
Was that now he's put you in front of me, which is not your favorite audience, but it's the other way around.
No, you have not
I understand.
Put me, because you opened it by saying, hello, everybody.
Yeah.
And I have never had an audience of everybody before.
I'm glad we can provide you with
this
singular opportunity. Before we move on, I am compelled by our corporate overlords to mention that Comedy Death Star is a production of Actors Comedy Studio and ACS Digital TV. Once again, I'm Denzel Myers. Our guest today is Dylan Brody. Hello.
Hello. I'm sorry I messed up your whole intro by insisting on giving factual information and updates.
Yeah, that doesn't usually happen on a comedy show, but I think in this case we'll be able to. We're going to work with it the best we can.
Thank you.
You have described yourself, or you were described to me as a word guy. You like words.
I am a purveyor of fine words and phrases. It says so on my business cards.
Yeah, what does that mean exactly to you?
Well, it means that I love language. I love the English language especially, as it's the only one I speak.
Yes.
But it means that I'm not as focused on simply getting a laugh every 15 seconds as is required for television comedy in the modern era, but rather I am committed to the idea of treating comedy as literature. Mm-hmm. That every sentence, every setup, every punchline, every image, every paragraph, everything that I speak or write should be well constructed. I just love the language and I love cadence. There's poetry.
Yes.
In all spoken word performance. There is poetry in all written word presentation, and there is poetry, I believe, in nature. And as language is our means of communicating, and our natural means of communicating, I feel it is important that we retain in that the beauty of the poetry.
The beauty of the words, yeah. Well, I asked you if you had, if you could bring in a word or a couple of short words or something. Did you bring any words or
several
short phrases?
There's a piece that I'm currently writing and rewriting, and there's a story behind it that I may or may not tell you. But I'm creating a list of English words that should be Yiddish but aren't.
Uh-huh.
I'm very fond of all of those.
Uh-huh.
Spatula.
Spatula sounds Yiddish to you?
Yes.
Okay.
Fetlock.
Fetlock, yeah, okay.
Yeah.
Is that the front of a horse's hoof?
That's exactly what
okay.
It is, yeah.
Not sure what part of my brain recalled that, but some part did.
Mint.
Mint?
Mint.
Why does mint sound Yiddish to you?
Well, you can put it in a Yiddish sentence. Moisten hassle mint. It sounds Yiddish. Felt is the same kind of thing.
Felt, for sure. I'm not going to give you any pushback with felt.
I've been composing this list for years, and uh-huh. Now I'm sort of narrowing it down for this piece. I'm trying to get into McSweeney's.
But so, what did you bring in today?
So that was one of the things that occurred to me when you
words. Yeah.
The other was a word that I love and have not found a place for yet mm-hmm. in anything I have written.
Mm-hmm.
Moribund.
How do you spell it exactly?
M-O-R-I-B-U-N-D.
Hmm.
Moribund.
Tell people what it means.
It is, as I would define it, it is dying through obsolescence. For instance...
So it is really to fade away. You fade away.
Yes.
Yeah. Neil Young, but this
is... Or already stagnant and therefore... beginning to fade away.
Yes.
It's not quite gone yet. How's my definition on that? Are you checking it?
No. I'm doing something else, but okay. I'm sure your definition is fine.
For instance, there are those who would say the traditional publishing industry is in a moribund state.
Right. Because it's just slowly losing air like a beach ball in October in the garage.
I don't know that that's true of the legacy publishing industry,
sure.
But it's something people say.
It's been said. Yeah, I've heard it.
That idea of already done and now going away, moribund.
Well,
and it's such a beautiful word.
Yeah.
That it has such richness of meaning for me. The idea of the end of a process, not death, but seeing death in the... There's a lot of mortality hidden in it.
Yes,
there's a lot about it that I like.
Okay.
And I keep intending to use it in something and not finding the proper way to do so.
Well...
Not finding the proper place.
You'll find the place. Eventually... Well, I'll tell you why I'm asking. As a, word guy the way you are. I'm not the same kind of word guy, but I have a very strange interest in anagrams.
I love anagrams.
I'm not an anagram genius, but, on the internet there's an anagram server. And so I put stuff into the anagram generator all the time that are interesting to me to see what comes out the other side. And in a certain way, I think it's science because it's not a random connection. Because the number of letters are are limited. And it's more to me like a mathematical function box. You put a 2 in, a 4 comes out. You put a 6 in, a 36 comes out. So I think that there's some kind of...
That would be a squaring.
That's a squaring function box. So so for moribund, for example, I put it in there, and there's not that many options for just that word. But one that comes out is dumb iron. And I guess the question is, so if you say, okay, moribund, dumb iron, does that add some texture, some color to moribund, or is there some connection between, you know, these two phrases that can both come from the same letters?
It doesn't specifically say anything to me, although it is the nature of the creative mind that I begin to generate my own connections between them. The idea that, first of all, I think about the fact that we now have fabric that can de-wrinkle itself. We
yes.
have travel-ready fabric,
yeah.
making the dumb iron, in fact, a moribund technology.
Yeah.
And the idea of a heavy and not particularly lasting metal is, in fact, moribund technology on its own.
Yeah.
We've advanced to steel and
right.
so on.
Exactly. That's the kind of process that is interesting to me.
I yeah. also have a fascination with anagrams, mm-hmm. although it became less of a fascination once the internet allowed me to just look them up. The fun for me was in finding the day that I realized that Newt Gingrich is an anagram of Twinge Grinch. It was a very big day for me.
Yes.
And I had to announce that in every show I did
right.
during the late 80s and early 90s.
Well, one of my favorites, and I'm not sure how I found this, I anagrammed Splitsville at a certain moment. Maybe I was in the middle of getting divorced at that time, so it could have been any number of years.
Yeah.
But it anagrams to pelvis still. So makes sense. If you split up with somebody, you stop getting laid.
Well, I would say that it's a reason to split up with somebody.
Pelvis still?
Yeah. If that's not happening,
yeah,
that's the time.
So it works both ways. It's on its way
right.
in and the way out. It can
that's correct.
Add some
that's,
color.
I want to say that it was David Steinberg. It may have been Dick Cavett who pointed out when I was a child that Spiro Agnew was an anagram of grow a penis.
I saw that one. I saw that one. Did you know, not speaking of Spiro Agnew, but did you know that Dylan Brody anagrams to ran by oddly?
I did not. I did not, and I'm surprised that I didn't.
I'm surprised, too, because it's your name.
Yeah, yeah. Over the years, I've certainly played with it as an anagram. Ran by oddly. I'm going to have to check that, because it doesn't seem right that I would not have known that if it is, in fact, true. I believe you, but only to the extent that I would be willing to check it to make certain that
yeah.
you are in earnest.
Yes. Well, unless I had some technical error.
Or misspelled my name.
Possible. But,
ran by oddly. That sounds right.
Yeah.
Two D's.
Sounds.
The L-Y.
Yeah.
They're two Y's, yeah.
Yeah,
yeah, that sounds right.
Yeah. It seems kind of fitting. I didn't meet you before today, but then when I saw that, I said, that sounds right for Dylan Brody.
I do run oddly.
Yeah,
do. I'm not good at running.
Physically, you
yeah.
do run
yeah.
oddly.
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
Well, it comes with self-consciousness.
So this anagram is actually revealing something about your person that most people may not know.
Or certainly reflecting something about my person that most people would not know.
One of the other things I want to talk about today is you have a book out called The Modern Depressive's Guidebook.
The Modern Depression Guidebook.
Depression?
Yeah. Yes, The Modern Depression Guidebook. That's correct.
I thought it said depressive.
Nope, The Modern Depression
Guidebook.
I'm
going to have to fix that.
Go
ahead.
Currently out of print. It will be again available. There's a chance that you can buy it right now from Amazon and download it, and the money will go into the ether and nobody will ever see it.
Right.
But within a few weeks, I think I'm going to have it back up under my own name. And
you're
it will be properly.
Re-release it.
Yes, it will be re-released and it will be properly attributed to me, and all the money will come to me, and it will be a much happier day for me.
Yes.
Via the depression.
Have you anagrammed the word depression?
No.
I did.
Oh, what do you got?
Well, you know, that's... Well, it was a 3,000. I mean, there's a lot of, you know, a lot of options. But I pulled a few out, and again, we're going to see if any of these kind of strike a chord or add some texture, color to it. So one is reposed sin. Another one is seed prison. Of course, person dies.
I would make it prison seed.
Prison seed.
Yeah.
Why do you want to switch those two around?
Because depression can be the seed that grows a proper prison.
I see.
Yes. It does not cause flora within a prison. Rather, it can grow into a prison. So
yeah,
I would make
perfect.
It prison seed.
Yeah, that makes sense to me. Person dies. That one obviously is pretty close. Diner posse. Don't know about that. Spider nose.
I'll bet there are many members of the original cast of the film Diner who...
Yes?
I imagine that Matt...
Elucidate.
Matt... What's his name?
Yeah, I know the guy. We know the guy.
Yeah.
He's famous. The star.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He's not...
We'll figure it out.
I don't think he's happy with his career.
Well...
I think that is a member of the Diner posse who...
These guys who all kind of peaked at that moment and now...
Yeah. There could be some depression in there.
Yeah. All right. Spider nose. Drone spies. This one I misspelled or mistyped. Here's one. Spined rose.
Nice.
Right?
Yeah.
That is super interesting. Yes, perfectly. Yeah, spined rose. That's it. That's...
Yeah,
there's something in that, right?
Yes.
When I read that spined rose, I thought, oh, of all the creative people I have ever known who were resistant to deal with their depression, work with their depression, you know, there's a certain kind of creative person that thinks that is their engine.
Yeah.
And they're afraid to mess with it.
They're wrong, by the way. Let me say publicly.
Yeah, please do.
That I have, since writing the book, I have overcome depression. Largely overcome depression. And I am pleased to report back from the other side that not only does one retain one's creativity and one's ability to think critically about the world while also being able to see daylight and enjoy life, moreover, it becomes possible to take action toward the betterment of one's own circumstance in ways that depression does not allow.
I believe all that. And at the same time, I think that for some people, especially if you're young, you know, it fuels your anger. And it's the thing that gets you out doing anything instead of folding in on yourself.
I think that is all part of the romanticization of depression that is dangerous and unhealthy and ultimately has caused far too many people I have known and loved to kill themselves.
Yeah.
So I say, if you can find a way clear of your depression, whether it be through inner work, through therapy, through medication, and I don't mean self-medication, because for 15 years I was stoned and depressed, and my therapist says that the marijuana kept me from committing suicide during that time, and he may be right, but also I was not able to properly advance myself in my career because I was depressed and stoned.
Right, yeah.
But if you can find your way properly clear of depression, do it. It will not, I promise you, it will not make you less creative or less active or less impassioned.
I'm tempted to ask a question about, you mentioned the romanticism.
Ask.
Well, I'm not sure if there's a, anyway, you mentioned depression gets romanticized.
Yes.
Why is that appealing, do you think? Why do we do that?
Well,
in our society.
It's not just our society. It's fairly widespread around the world.
Yeah. To romanticize...
Certainly in Russian culture.
Well, the Russians, yeah.
It is because whatever our experience is, we must, in order to feel sanguine with it as our own history and our own experience, we must, to some degree, romanticize it or change it. Why are the 50s romanticized? It's the same thing. It's part of our history. We need to feel as though there was something there that we can love. And because mental illness, not just depression, but mental illness in general, often appears in the most creative people, two things happen. One is that an inaccurate cause and effect relationship is imposed on it, when in fact what there is just concordance.
Yes.
Of the two. So people think that the creativity depends on the depression, and that creates a romanticization. Oh, he's okay. So depressed, he must be very creative. And the other thing that happens is that because the most creative people are also the most, are largely the same people who experience depression, there's a lot of creativity about depression.
Mm-hmm.
The writers who write about depression.
Got it.
And so on. And it's only in recent years that a lot of the tools to fight depression have come into being. So we have generations of writers and painters and artists who were depressed and creative and creating stuff about how great their depression is and how important it is to them, and at the same time reinforcing the idea that the depression is necessary for the creativity.
As you're talking about all that, I think about Mary Shelley.
There you go.
Right? And
yeah.
How I mean, when yeah. Percy and, met her, she was sitting in the graveyard, on a tombstone, and that he took one look at her and just fell in love. And, yeah, talk about a melancholic personality. There are a couple other anagrams for depression. Spined Rose, that's a good one. Snide Poser.
By the way, Spined Rose was also one of my aunts on my mother's side.
Snide Poser. Not your favorite aunt.
No.
Doesn't sound like
anyone's. You know what she was?
What?
She was a snide poser.
She was a snide poser. That could be one of the diner posse guys.
That's correct.
Dope Sirens. Eh. But this one I thought was interesting. Id Response.
Nice.
Right?
Yeah.
Depression. Id Response. I only think that one was good because I realized that I immediately blocked it out. And that's probably a good sign. Yeah, I don't, Id Response. I'm not even sure what to make out of that, but it just makes me pause and I say, "Wow."
Well, I think I don't think there's magic in anagrams, but I think what you're noticing there is that some depression revolves around self-loathing.
Yeah.
That comes as a response to the demands of the id. Sometimes the things that we want and crave and hope to gorge upon are things that cause us shame, and it is the response to those that might lead to depression.
Well, I think there's a kind of a good case that the things that are in our shadow areas that we don't want to be, right? The parts of ourselves that we don't like, that we push away, that we resist. If we can change the relationship with those parts of ourselves, something else happens. Growth happens.
That's correct.
Yeah. So
So if you want to have a growth... Wait, what?
The book, Modern Depression Guidebook.
Yes.
Here's the spoiler alert. Spoiler alert. Two things. It's funny.
Yes. And, God, I hope so.
And it will not fix anything.
Oh, no, no, no. The Modern Depression Guidebook was written in the depth of a depression.
Yes.
15 years, I guess, before 10 years before I got medicated for depression. Before I stopped smoking pot all the time, before I started studying martial arts, before I developed any of the tools that I now have to fight depression. And I still believed at that time that the only way, that first of all, every depression was because I was trying to write my next project. And it was just something that I had to do before I wrote. Hmm. And
in that way we were talking about, like that was you gathering your,
yeah, I believe,
your creative energies.
I genuinely believed that that was necessary to my process.
Yeah, yeah.
And the book was, I believed, a way that I was going to write myself out of depression forever. And it is a guidebook on how to have your best depression.
Mm-hmm. So the advice there is to have it fully. Have it. Not yes. to push it away. To have it and revel in it and claim it. And
get your deepest possible blues yes. and your darkest possible well-like depths. And don't try to make it happen in less time. Because nothing is going to make anything better.
Really maximize the opportunity.
Maximize the opportunity afforded yeah. by depression. The idea is this. Any depressive knows that he or she has never accomplished anything of value. He or she knows that he or she has never done anything well.
Right.
Depression is one thing, at least, that you can be good at. So I offer in the book handy exercises to improve and increase your self-loathing.
Mm-hmm.
I have tips to skew your sleep patterns. I have rules to avoid basic personal hygiene. and it ultimately builds to suicidal ideation. I don't suggest ever that one commit suicide for two reasons.
Two reasons. Okay.
One is that I fear litigation.
That's a good reason.
And the other is that just puts an end to a perfectly good depression.
And it could be so much more.
Yeah.
It could be so much more.
You could still do it better. Yeah. But I do suggest thinking about suicide a lot and coming up with your most creative and engaging possible ways of committing suicide. Because that's just a good way to use the time when you're not sleeping.
I understand. And now, so you were depressed when you wrote the book. You were hoping that it would get you out of it.
Yes.
The book is all about going deeper, as deep as you possibly
yes.
can, into it.
Yes.
When you go into this thing that, you know, you probably have been resisting on some level most of your life or all of your
depression?
Life. Yeah.
Yes.
To me, it's like the journey to the center of the earth. I mean, what do you find at this center if you really go into it in a way you never have before?
Oh, my mom.
She was there with a bundt cake.
That's right. She was just there worshiping at the altar of unfulfilled potential. And no, that is mean of me, and it is glib, and it is actually not true.
But it was funny, so thanks for saying
it. Well, thank you.
Yeah.
There's a lot of guilt, uh-huh. and some of it about the way I talk about my mom. There's a lot of shame about my sexuality and the nature of my sexuality and the oddness of my fetish. There is a certain amount of fear of unworthiness for the response to and the benefits from my natural gifts that don't feel like something I do, just something I have.
So all these things make sense. You know, you go in and you find it there and, you know, you get these explanations. And yes, I guess my question was just about experientially to really to go into the, you know, into the deepest part of the cave. Aside from the things that you understood and made sense, was it a different kind of world? Just when I read about it, it did. It seemed like a journey to the center of the earth where none of the normal rules may apply and you have no idea what you're going to find there.
Well, I'm not quite certain. I don't fully understand the question, I think, because...
Yeah, maybe not. Maybe I don't understand the question.
Do you experience depression? Is this something you...
Yeah, I mean, yes. In the past year, I have come to the realization that this is an issue for me, and it has been true for as long as I can remember. And up until now, I have always written it off as there's something happening and, you know... it's occasional. It's because of something,
right.
as opposed to it's something that I have had my entire life, and it always affects me. So,
at the center of it mm-hmm. is an insistent negativity uh-huh. that colors the reception of everything around me.
Okay.
And the perception.
Yeah.
I mean, I will tell you a story.
Yes.
I've told it a few times, but I haven't really recorded it yet. I haven't told it on stage. I haven't fully refined it yet. When I first became medicated against depression, I smoked pot for years, and then I found martial arts, and that was helping. And then I was able to quit smoking pot before I tested for my first black belt. And for 10 years, the training was enough to fend off most of the depression, but I wasn't getting anything else done. I was just training all the damn time. And refinding who I was without being stoned all the time, as I had been since adolescence. And then the depression eventually came back, and a friend suggested I try medication. I later found out that he was also experiencing depression, and he wanted me to find out for him whether medication worked. And the first thing they tried me on was Prozac, and it had a horrible adverse side effect for me. I just quit that. And the next thing they tried was Paxil, because of the nature of the pharmaceutical industry and the lack of understanding of the workings of the brain, that when you get medicated, they have to just try stuff on you and see what has the desired.
Yeah, they don't know exactly what's going on.
So there's a lot of weaning on to things and weaning off of things for some people. For me, it was just the second thing we tried, Paxil, and I felt the depression lifting, and I felt it happening over the course of a couple of weeks. And after about 8 months on Paxil, my psychiatrist said, so shall we wean you off of it? And I said, oh, okay. And I went from, I don't know the milligram dosage, but I went from one pill to 3/4 of a pill to start weaning off. And I was down to 3/4 of a pill for, I think, 3 or 4 days. I was driving to a meeting. And my internal monologue was one that used to be with me all the time and that I hadn't noticed had disappeared until it came back. I was driving to this meeting, and I was figuring out all the things I could be angry about when I got there. The traffic wasn't that bad, but I was going to be pissy about the traffic. And are they going to make me pay for parking? I'm not going to a meeting where they're going to make me pay for. They better cover my. And if I have to drive around looking for, that's not right. So they better have validated free parking at then, and better not be hard to find. And I just, these things that I was finding to be mad about that hadn't occurred yet, right?
Right. And might never occur.
And might never occur. And I got there plenty early, because I always leave plenty of time to get. So, like, even when I was worried about traffic, I still had plenty. It's not like I was going to be late. And there was a parking spot right out front that I pulled into. And I called my psychiatrist, and I said, so this is weird. I've got down to 3/4 of a pill a day, 3 days, and I can feel all the darkness on the planet gathering at the base of my spine and climbing up to infest the crevices of my brain. Does that make any sense? And he said, wow, and you're telling me that we were treating you for your first bout of depression? And I said, what? No, I never said that. I've been depressed all my life.
As long as I can remember, yeah.
And he said, oh, then just stay on it. You're clearly supremely attuned to this particular drug. Stay on it. And then he said the thing that really stunned me. If it's a first bout of depression, there's a 50-50 chance that we can rebalance the chemicals and you'll be fine from there on. If it's a chronic condition, all we can do is keep the medication going. And if it stops working, change it up. So I stayed on it. But in that moment when I could feel it coming back,
yes,
there was an awareness that this has been with me my whole life. I remember walking to school thinking about, you know, when I was in second grade, thinking about what was going to be upsetting to me today that I could be angry at someone for. I was getting off on my anger. It was just absurd.
I can really relate to that business about identifying, right? The voice went away, or that feeling went away, and then when it came back, you said, oh, wow, this is a thing. This is not just me.
Well, it is just me.
But it's not all of you, and you got some separation from it, and you felt when that changed, yeah.
And apparently I have found a medication that just shuts that guy up in my head.
Right.
And I'm glad, because I don't like that guy. That guy's a dick.
Yeah, what do you know about that guy? Who is that guy?
I know he's a dick. I know he's the guy that damaged my career for 30 years. You know, I know he's the guy that alienated people I had no desire to alienate. He's the guy that that stopped me from showing people scripts. He's the guy that stopped me from advancing my my performing career for years. He's not someone I want to hang out with.
Yeah. And physically, does he look like you? Does he look different than you?
Oh, he looks exactly like me.
So is physically you.
And in fact, I like his appearance. There are elements of his appearance that I still try to emulate.
So he doesn't look exactly like you. You try to emulate. Well, what are the ways you try to emulate him?
There's a seriousness in my demeanor sometimes that is more him than any other element of me. I tie to him a certain amount of my political pomposity, mm-hmm. my professorial concern with the world, and I'm able to access all those things as I need them without then also having to listen to his nonsense lectures about how nothing I do is good enough and everybody else is getting in my way.
In your writing and in your work, do you let him speak sometimes?
Yeah, frequently on Twitter.
Okay.
He blurts things out on Twitter from time to time.
Right.
I think yesterday he... I never thought about it in this way before. I never thought about that guy as that guy.
Yeah.
It's kind of interesting to do in front of an audience of everybody. So thanks for that. Look, there he was. The snarky.
I got that snarky. Your eyebrows changed and your head tilted down and you looked up at me through your eyebrows, which was super snarky, and I hadn't seen that physical gesture, facial gesture. So there you go.
Welcome to that guy. Yesterday, I think I tweeted something about... people, look up the difference between the word adverse and averse. I can't have this conversation every day.
I saw that.
All those. There's a recurring thing in my stories. I'm trying to remember what. I do a thing about people who say take a different tact when they mean take a different tack. And then I explain what the idiom is. And I say my point is, if you have been saying take a different tact, people like me have been judging you harshly. And all of I've got a bunch of people like me have been judging you harshly jokes, and they're all that guy. They're all the hypercritical language guy.
So that's him. Well, I have a language question, because we're roughly the same age or in the same decade-ish.
You're clearly younger than I.
I don't know that that's true, but thank you.
Okay.
We can check that out off the air. We might not want to let everyone know what
I was born in 1964. I am unashamed of the truth.
Okay. Well, I was born in 1962, which makes me unashamed to be older than you are.
And to appear significantly younger.
Dorian Gray could do it. I
have been feeling my age for the past few years, and I visited my folks on the East Coast. Uh-huh. And I went into their attic, and I found a painting of me that was done when I was in my 20s.
Yes.
The painting, the guy in the painting, hasn't aged at all.
Creepy.
Yeah.
Creepy.
I think it cursed me.
So here's my language question.
Yes.
when I was a kid, we got corrected. I'm not sure I got corrected, but young people got corrected because they used me when they really meant I.
Yes.
Correct?
Yes.
Right? Like... And me and Jim went to the grocery store, and adults would say, "No, that's not correct." Jim and I went to the grocery store, but I believe that I hear in the past 10 years, young people today say "I" all the time incorrectly
on television. Television writers are using "I" incorrectly. Yeah, between you and I, but it infuriates me. My wife and I sit there and cringe together. and we say, kids these days, get off my lawn.
But there must have been some kind of like a super backlash. I don't think it was organized, but after all those decades of telling young people you're using me when you should be using I, and now everyone's using I when they should be using me.
People started to think that me always sounds wrong if there is someone else in the sentence.
Yeah.
They do it right if it's just them.
Yeah, generally. Yeah.
They would not say he gave that to I.
No.
But then they would say
he gave it to Jim and I.
Yes.
They will say that.
And in that case, of course, it is the pronoun that we left out the representative antecedent, chlamydia. He gave chlamydia to Jim and me.
The
object of the sentence, not the subject of the sentence.
Right.
What I tell people is just take the other person out of the equation.
Well, that's what I learned.
And you immediately know.
That's what I learned.
But they still don't learn.
Does that still work?
Yes.
That's reliable, right?
It's reliable, but people don't believe me and they don't do it. And
yeah.
And I cringe.
Okay.
Because I judge them harshly.
I just wanted to check because I try not to correct people. You know, that doesn't go over very well a lot of times when you say, you know what, you really mean this. So
yeah, I have a dear friend who is a successful writer, and I love her, and I have given her this note a dozen times.
In her writing or in verbal?
In her writing and in person, and it just does not stick. It will not stick.
All right, but it's not my imagination that people are now screwing this up the opposite way they did when I was a young person.
I'm like professional writers.
Yeah.
I've not bothered to learn this distinction.
Yeah, yeah.
Also, whom?
I'm less clear how to explain the differences there, but I know that mistakes there happen all the time. Yeah. Is there a simple rule like
to keep whom is the object and who is the subject?
Well, but you just mentioned that people don't really know what the object and subject is anymore, so telling them that is not helpful. Give me an example.
Who did this to you?
Yes.
Is who is the subject of the sentence, even though it's a question, you are looking for the active person in the sentence.
Who has agency. What has agency.
Yes. Or what has agency.
Who's doing something, yeah.
As opposed to, this was done to you by whom, in which case this becomes the subject of the sentence, to get there. Expeditiously, I put us in the passive voice, which I would never do in a writing exercise.
But on radio, it's totally fine to be in a passive voice.
Oh, interesting. By whom?
I read that, I think, somewhere.
It was read by you.
It was read by whom?
Exactly. Because now the object of the preposition, by whom.
Right.
I would like to speak to whomever. Because you're dealing with me as the subject, or in this case, I as the subject, and I have the action, and the person to whom I would speak is the object.
Even over the radio, I can see people glazing over. I'm not saying that it's incorrect.
I don't spend a lot of time on this in my head.
Now, there's a good reason for that. All right, let me move on to something else.
Certainly, by all means.
You mentioned in passing a few moments ago about your, I forget the word that you used, your...
Penis?
No, but close. Oh. Your interest, your sexuality.
Oh, yes.
Your sexual interests. And I was going to ask a question. I watched a video that you have about where you're talking about being sexually attracted to women who are physically disabled.
That is correct.
And so I wanted to check.
In particular, amputees.
I wanted to check in if that was real, and
that is absolutely real.
Especially amputees.
Especially amputees. And deeply troubling to me, and a source of great pleasure to me. And I believed until the advent of the internet, I believed that I was entirely alone in this in the world.
Well, that happens, yes.
But that's not true because there were a couple of letters to Penthouse and one comic book that I discovered in my youth that told me, oh, I am not entirely alone in this in the universe. But there was no way to discuss it with anyone I knew. There was no way to find information on it.
Right.
It was... And then the internet happened, and suddenly we all found each other, and the world changed in that regard.
Yeah.
In the short interim between meeting and dating and being dumped by the woman who was physically the woman of my dreams, mm-hmm. and the time that I got my first 14.4 dial-up modem. I met and fell in love with the woman who is my wife, who has all of her original parts. And I have often said that, as far as I'm concerned, her only flaw is her physical perfection. But it's...
And what does she have to say about that? And, I mean, you've been together for quite a while, so obviously...
We've been together for 21 years, yeah. And we are very pleased that our marriage is now old enough to drink. so I guess we've been together for 22. We've been married for 21. You would have to ask her what she has to say about that. She's lovely, and you can talk to her anytime you like.
Yeah, all right.
Her name escapes me at the moment.
Okay. Well, it's probably written down somewhere in your wallet or something.
I promise her for our 25th anniversary, I will memorize it.
Well, you have some time.
Yeah.
You got some time. I watched that videotaped story of this younger part of your life, and I said, wow, what is it like for you, or what, you go at this subject just straight head on. It's a subject some people might be embarrassed about, not want to talk about, not want to reveal, and you just go straight at it.
Yes. It took me a long time to do that.
Yes.
And I don't feel as though I do go straight at it. I know I say it aloud.
Right.
But I feel as though I couch it in a lot of care. I haven't quite gotten as direct on it as I feel I could be.
Hmm. How do audiences respond to that story in particular?
It is very well received. It feels to them very brave, I'm sure, and certainly unexpected and very funny. And I think in many cases leaves them with questions about, could that be true? Could he really? Could that be?
It seems like if it wasn't true and you said all that, that would be awful.
Yeah.
Yeah, then you would get beat up in the parking lot. But, that's, you know, the only thing
you
have...
Artist. No one beats me up in the parking lot anymore. And the less fearful I am of that, the more authentically myself I'm able to be on stage. Mm-hmm. I had wanted for a long time to be able to deal with this on stage, to be open about it. I think that one of the jobs of artists is to reveal and explore the truth of the world they experience as bravely and openly and honestly as they are capable of doing, because they are the only ones who can make it safe for the non-artists of the world to explore thoughts and ideas and truths that are traditionally or culturally taboo. And it is in those shadowed areas of the human experience that we lose people. That people are swept into alcoholism or addiction or any of the other myriad symptoms of the disease that is shame and isolation.
Right.
And anytime I can step forward and stand in the light and say, this is the world that I see, and I am certain some other people see it that way and feel shame over it or feel isolated because of it, well, you're not alone. It is my responsibility and my most earnest desire to do so. And as an artist, it's my job to do it in a way that is palatable and entertaining or, you know, pretty, in some way beautiful, right, to bring the beauty out in that which has been hidden for fear of ugliness.
Well, when you say it, I'm sorry, go ahead.
So that it's not easy for me to say on stage or here in a room with you into a microphone. It's not easy for me to say, yes, I find amputees incredibly erotically exciting. It feels as though, and part of the shame comes from the fact that it feels as though somehow I'm taking pleasure in someone else's tragedy and trauma. It feels as though there is a subtext of power play that is not appealing. And there's all sorts of reasons that I can find that people would find that off-putting, or that I would find it off-putting, were it not my thing.
Right.
And I feel shame about it. But if I can simply and honestly say, this is what I feel, regardless of what other judgments I attach to it, it may allow some other people to go, oh, thank God I'm not just alone in the world.
Yeah, it's not just me. Yeah.
If you've ever read Jenny Lawson, she's a wonderful writer. She writes a lot about her own mental illness.
Mm-hmm.
She's very funny. Her first book was called Let's Pretend This Never Happened. Her second one that just came out is called Furiously Happy. And she got her start as a bloggist, thebloggist.com. Very funny, very smart. And she talks about her mental illness openly. And she has this following of people who go to hear her read at bookstores and will understand if she says, I need a minute, and curls up under the podium to hold a stuffed animal for a minute before she comes back to keep reading, because she's freaked out. And we all need to know that we are not alone in the world. And those of us who have the capacity to let others feel that way, feel less alone in the world, should make use of that capacity.
Well, I love what you have said in that whole thing. There's a responsibility, or you feel a certain responsibility. There's a service orientation. You're not doing this to indulge yourself.
Oh, no.
You have a sense of service and connection and reaching out to other people. And
it's an indulgence.
Of course.
It relieves me of some shame every time I reveal myself and am well-received.
Shame is disconnecting. And if you can reveal that and receive feedback from other people, that is reconnecting. And so, being selfish or doing something for yourself and something for others are not mutually exclusive. You can do both.
I have said time and again, and it's something I only learned after I stopped smoking pot and really began to examine my experience in Los Angeles. Entertainment is the word people use when they don't want to take responsibility for what they say through their art.
Well, that sounds almost like a Mark Twain kind of statement.
Well, thank you. No, I can live with that.
You know what I mean?
I do.
Yeah.
In my solo show, I actually have my father say it to me on the phone, because it's the kind of thing that sounds better if it's coming from someone else than if it's something that I'm saying pompously.
Right.
But I think that it's the same thing that causes some comics to defend something by saying it's just a joke. It's the most powerful tool you have at your disposal.
Yeah.
If you have to defend something that you've said by saying it's just a joke, rewrite it so that it's not just a joke, it's saying what you want to say. And I think there is a responsibility. If we were to call ourselves artists, there is a responsibility.
It's interesting. One of the things I had written down to talk about today with you or float out is, about the jester, fool, clown archetype, which comedy obviously has a lot. But, the root of that is that is a creature who gets to speak the unspeakable thing. And the reason in medieval times that the jester, and even now maybe, can say that is that they're the lowest status animal in the pack, right? They're not the people who are the winners. They're not in control. They're not in power. They're the idiots. So the job of the idiot is to be able to say the unspeakable. And there's a service. Society needs that. People need that.
The comics we remember and the comics I admire are the ones who genuinely had something to say and weren't just there to get a laugh. When you look at what George Carlin was doing, in opening up the language and exploring the language of oppression and the language of war, he changed the way we thought about things. Richard Pryor gave us a look into the community and the life that he had experienced that white people had never gotten and that blacks had never seen exposed.
Mm-hmm.
Bill Hicks did really interesting explorations of the politics of the time, Sam Kinison, who I hung out with some and argued with late into the night in cocaine-fueled rages, both of us. I disagreed with his politics deeply, but he was genuinely exploring the truth of his perception of the world, and he was able to make it very funny.
Yeah.
And it is, and Lord Buckley, for whom my youngest dog is named.
Your dog is named Buckley or Lord Buckley?
Lord Buckley, Sweet Lips, Greatest of All Dane Mucks, the dinosaur slaying dog. His theme song is part of his name.
I saw a little like TM at the end of all of that. Nice. So it's trademarked.
Yeah. These are guys who were really exploring. So they were not just saying, I got to get a 4-to-1 laugh per minute ratio. Right. Here's how a joke is structured. I'm going to string a bunch of those together. They had something to say. And I think that artists think about what they want to say.
All right, I'm going to switch things up.
Every time you cover your face with your papers, I'm afraid I need a breath mint.
I would consider that just a personal quirk.
Okay.
Yours and or mine.
Okay.
Why, have I done this?
Yeah.
Oh, I wasn't aware of even doing this.
Every time it makes me think I need a breath. Do you have a breath mint?
I don't have a breath mint, but you're totally fine.
Okay, good. You're fine.
Do I need a breath mint?
No.
Do you have a breath mint? You don't
if
have
I
a breath
mint. Would not be asking, having this conversation.
Wouldn't be asking me if I had a breath mint. All right. No.
But I do have as a general rule of thumb for everybody, always accept the breath mint.
Yeah, if you're offered...
If someone offers you a breath mint, don't say no thanks.
Don't say no thanks, no.
Accept the breath mint.
No, yeah, I get that one. Yeah, that's a good rule to live by. Always accept the breath mint. You have a somewhat quirky sleeping ritual. What is it?
I have a quirky sleeping ritual?
I'm from Philadelphia. The way I ask a question is I say something, I make a statement, and if it's false, then people say, what the hell are you talking about? But, but this is my assertion. You have a somewhat quirky sleeping ritual. What is it?
I don't think of it as that quirky. I sleep in blocks. I sleep... I'm generally up very late. I generally nap during the day. I like it if my dogs will join me when I nap. They don't always want to. The late, great cat, Jojo Precious, Tiger Kitty, the cat who could tell time, liked it when I napped. Frequently, I would get up from wherever I was sitting, and he would head toward the bedroom and then look over his shoulder. We're going to do this now, right? He and I were very good napping buddies. But I don't think of it as that quirky.
This is me fishing. You'd be surprised what some people would say.
How did you know that?
You would be surprised.
How did you know about the thing that I do with the goldfish?
It's another question in the same vein. As a child, you had an imaginary friend.
Yes, I did.
That imaginary friend also had an imaginary friend. Where are they now?
That's interesting. That imaginary friend has returned to... the island of the shrinking, growing dinosaurs from whence it had come.
Wait, is this your imaginary friend or your friend's imaginary
friend? It's my imaginary friend, but
imaginary
all of his
friends.
Imaginary friends would... his friends weren't imaginary, clearly. He has real friends. He was my imaginary friend.
Yeah.
But his friends live on the island.
Though they're real.
Oh, yeah, sure.
Well, sometimes imaginary friends also have imaginary friends. I've had that experience.
My imaginary friend was not that imaginative.
Not that imaginative.
Yeah.
But I'm a little curious now about the island of shrinking...
And growing
and
dinosaurs.
Is it some grow and some shrink, or they go through periods where they grow, and then they shrink, and then they grow again
later? Oh, I understand why that's confusing. No, he is a dinosaur that is capable of... changing his size to fit the need of the situation.
Oh, so they have complete control over.
Usually,
this.
Yeah. He was in my pocket.
Aha. Uh-huh.
And then when he wanted to be bigger, I would bring him out of my pocket.
Got it.
And he could be bigger and
Got
hang
it.
Out. And,
Got it.
It turned out that all of the dinosaurs from his home could do this, and he was sort of confused that we didn't do it.
Well, that would be confusing if you came.
Very imaginative, as I said.
Came from a land like that,
yeah.
And then you come to another place where people can't do that at all. That would
exactly right. And his name was Keith.
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 What color is Keith? Do you recall?
Was invisible.
Oh,
was
okay.
Imaginary.
Okay.
Yeah.
Imaginary and invisible sometimes go together and sometimes do not.
I understood that he was both invisible and imaginary, even as I adored him.
Okay. Well, I asked because when you started to describe the island of growing and shrinking dinosaurs, I mean, I got a visual.
I understand. But have you ever seen it on a map?
Well, no.
Do you know why?
Maybe it's just not labeled properly. It could just not be labeled properly.
Invisible. Although I will tell you...
So the whole island is invisible?
Yeah.
How do they find their keys? Their car keys? Or, you know, how do they...
That's silly. Shrinking and growing dinosaurs don't have cars.
Now, here I thought you were going to say they don't drive cars because they all have those Google automated driving vehicles.
There. Don't need them. Very small island.
Okay.
I will tell you, though, that I hadn't thought about Keith in a long, long time.
Yeah.
But when you asked me about Keith, I did a little check-in on him, and he's fine.
He's fine.
Just to know that he's fine. He's still there.
Yeah, what is he up to today? I mean, he's still
just
still
hanging
there?
Out eating leaves.
Still there?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. And when, how long has Keith been with you?
He was with me from, I would say, first grade until I left for prep school. I think he took off when I left for prep school.
But he's still here. He's saying he's still around.
No, he's on the island.
Oh, he's on the island.
Yeah,
he's there, and you checked him out. Do you communicate telepathically? Is there some kind of drum that is connects you two? I mean, how you checked in with him?
I just checked in with him.
Okay.
I didn't really think about how I did
it. Right.
I know I didn't need to pull out my phone for it.
You don't. Yeah, that's good. Okay. All right, I like that. this is kind of a forced choice thing about your preferences. Jelly or marmalade?
Jelly.
Lacrosse or Hi-Li?
Oh, neither.
You're not into ball sports?
I'm not into ball and net sports, certainly. I guess it would be lacrosse just because I'm a prep school guy.
Okay.
But no, I don't really.
You're not interested in either one. No. All right. Underwear or commando?
Underwear.
Whatever happened to Juan Carlos, that kid from Ecuador?
I'm guessing found a home and made a great deal of money in the coffee industry, but I'm not certain of that.
The coffee industry has been going through some changes.
Yeah.
They got some new fungus down there. Anyway, all right. Juan Carlos. have you ever hit anyone in the face with a pie?
I have not.
Why not? Is it appealing to you?
It is not appealing to me. That seems to me like an act of violence masked in stock comedy.
Okay.
And I am pretty much a fan of nonviolent comedy.
Yeah.
Marx Brothers over Stooges.
Yeah. Well, this is just an aside. Your martial art work, is it no contest, no contact, or you have contact?
Oh, no, I was the...
full contact?
I was the Golden State heavyweight champion, full contact.
All right, so that's full contact and full contest.
Yeah.
Well, I understand this thing about the pie, because I agree, most of the time a pie is thrown with some aggression there. But if you had permission to hit someone in the face with a pie...
Yeah. Waste of good pie.
Really?
Yeah.
Not that interesting.
No.
A historical figure, perhaps? Somebody would want to hit in the face with a pie?
No.
Not necessarily?
No.
That's fascinating to me.
People enjoy being given permission to carry out any act of aggression. It changes the dynamic enormously. Frequently in teaching martial arts, particularly with new students, with white belts and yellow belts, and the beginners... I can see the resistance to the idea. They'll kick a paddle, but then as soon as it's kicking a person, they... And when I give someone permission to kick or to punch me, because a person early in training has very little power in their kicks and punches.
Right.
And when I give them permission to kick me or punch me as hard as they can, there is great joy that I see in that moment.
Yeah.
And they don't want to admit that there's great joy in it. I see the masking of it at the same time, but there is great joy in it and a giggling kind of delight in having done it. There's an Aikido principle. I haven't studied a lot of Aikido. I studied Hapkido, which is the Korean equivalent, but it's philosophically a little bit different. But there's an Aikido principle that says that when someone punches you, when someone attacks you, they are craving physical contact.
I did not know that. And I love it.
And it enables you, once you realize that they are seeking physical contact, it enables you to respond in a way that accepts and embraces their physical contact as both self-defense and an offering.
Craving. Craving is the key word here.
A dear friend of mine, I mentioned this in one of my stories that I just told recently, actually. A dead dear friend of mine, the day that we met, where I was 17, he was 16, something like that, we were introduced to one another and spontaneously began wrestling in slow motion. And it was, you know, interconnected, supported. You know, we were both competing for male dominance and cooperating in unexpected improvisational physical exploration. And the people who had just introduced us were baffled by it. And he and I were instantly best friends.
Yeah. No, I think that's perfect. You figured out a game that you were going to play together, and you instantly knew the rules.
Yeah.
And it was all, it needed to be all those things, physical and slow motion and engaging. Well, my guest today here on Actors Comedy Studio Comedy Death Star podcast has been Dylan Brody.
I played the part of Dylan Brody.
He played the part of Dylan Brody. Storyteller, comedian, Taekwondo master. Thanks for coming in this week. If you would like to buy a Comedy Death Star coffee mug, you can email us at comedydeathstar@acsdigital.tv. Dylan Vigil is our producer and engineer. Our theme music was written and performed by Dean Mermel. You have been listening to Comedy Death Star, the official podcast of Actors Comedy Studio, right here in Hollywood, USA. I am your host, Denzel Myers. Thank you for listening, and we will be back next week.